You're listening to The Blind Spot, a podcast from Thomas Pocklington Trust.
My name is Penny Wilkinson, and welcome to another episode of the podcast. In October, we had a panel talking about Braille in the modern age. Today, we're talking about how assistive technology has meant that some people no longer use Braille at all. And I'm joined by Matthew Johnson, a lawyer, linguist, and musician. Welcome, Matthew.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good, thanks. Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So I am originally from the island of Bermuda. I came to England half my life ago, so roughly 15 years ago, completed my education here and got a job here as a lawyer. I do IT and data law at a national level. And aside from that, my first degree was in languages, so I'm comfortable in French, Spanish, and German. And just to cover off your final point, I suppose, I'm a musician as well. I play country and acoustic guitar.
Brilliant. And may I ask about your level of sight and your sight condition?
I've never had any.
So you were blind from birth?
Correct.
Can I ask, how did you get into the legal profession, and did you face any particular barriers or challenges to get into this career?
I mean, that's a very wide-ranging question. So the first thing about, obviously, the legal profession is not easy to enter. It never has been. It's even more challenging, I would say, in the last 10 or 15 years or so with the prevailing economic conditions and the ups and downs that we've had. But in terms of access, so I did my first degree was in languages, as I said. And then what you would do is something called the GDL, the General Diploma in Law. And it's for people who already have a degree. And it compresses an entire 3-year law degree into the most intense 1-year period of your life. I think I broke a coffee maker about 3/4 of the way through that year. And then you choose your route, your barrister or solicitor route, and you do what's called the LPC, in my case, to become a solicitor. That is changing, but that is historically the way it has worked. They're changing it in the next couple of years, but that's what I did.
As a blind person, did you face any additional barriers or challenges to get into that?
I mean, there's always, you know, questions around, is this text going to be accessible? Is this online learning system going to be accessible? Things like, I don't know if they're still using it, but Blackboard, you know, the online learning system that a lot of higher education institutions use, basically wasn't accessible at all. And you have to fight through that. There were situations where there were obviously lectures and breakout workshops where, you know, each group would present on a particular, for example, point of law or issue in a contract or disputed area of a case. You'd have 5 or 6 different groups, and each one would have a whiteboard and obviously would jot their points on the whiteboard and then present them to the group. So, of course, there were always issues following that, because what everyone would do is just take a picture of each whiteboard on their phone, and then suddenly they had all the notes.
Yeah.
Great if you can do it. So I had, you know, disabled students finance. I had a note taker who made sure that I had the same access as everyone else and that I was able to access the notes and things like that. So yeah, it takes some doing and it takes a level of perseverance to do it. But thanks to something, you know, things like DSA and elbow grease, you can usually get there.
Right. Okay. And as a practicing lawyer now, what does your daily job entail, and what assistive technology enables you to do your job?
Daily job mostly consists of swearing and pulling my hair out. So in terms of what I do, so I work on large sort of IT contracts. That's one of the main things that I do. I think, you know, multi-year, $500,000 to $1 million plus or more, you know, on the table for large software development contracts and things like that. One of the main things that I would use for that is just, you know, I just use a Surface Pro with JAWS on it to access that. There's some special scripting that the firm has had to put in place to access things like the document management system. So obviously where all of the contract files and emails and client information is stored, you know, that would be that's something that is specific and oftentimes is not accessible. That's a whole other topic of why these very, very popular management systems that are used by thousands and thousands of law firms and accountancy practices across the world aren't accessible. But that's a different problem. But we've often had to bring in, you know, special scripting work scripters to do that work and to make those things accessible. But the heart of the system is a laptop and it's JAWS. I also have access to the services of one of the paralegals in our team who, where needed, will make things accessible and also make sure that, for example, in my contracts, if the formatting breaks horribly, if there's some kind of really dramatic numbering issue or alignment issue, or suddenly my font changes color, she'll point out those kind of things. You have to be good with Word already in order to do this. You have to have very, very good JAWS, Word, and web research skills to begin with, right? But you needed them to do the degree anyway. But the final check, is often done by my assistant.
Maybe I've watched too many terrible legal dramas on TV, but doesn't the job involve large tomes of case law to read through? Have these all now been digitized?
Well, you say this. There was actually a session when I was a trainee, when I began as a trainee, and the session was with all the trainees of the firm, and it was something along the lines of how to reference case law manually, because in our degree, we almost never had to do it. Now we almost never have to do it. There was one notable exception when I was in the wills and estates team when I had to reference 1940s tax law, and that I needed a book for. And obviously then I needed a paralegal to help. But there's so much online now. I obviously we're all working from home now, pretty much all of us because of COVID. And I can certainly say that no one's missed access to a law library. barristers, it may differ with barristers who need to conduct sort of complex legal research. But even then, the blind barristers that I know don't need to have recourse to print.
So turning to Braille, did you actually learn Braille at school?
I did when I was younger. I think getting into a little bit of my background might be helpful here because it very much informs my worldview. As I say, I was in Bermuda. I was one of the first visually impaired people in Bermuda to receive more than a basic education. And part of that meant that we were always struggling to access materials in one way or another. Right. School books had to be made accessible in one way or another. And of course, this was the 90s and early 2000s where, electronic resources weren't half as prevalent as they are now. And so we were constantly in negotiations with publishers in America or, blind organizations in America and Canada to have these things sent across. And of course, Braille is heavy. Braille is bulky. That means Braille is expensive to make and ship. There was always this push and pull with, well, we don't have that yet. And then the net effect of that was oftentimes I had to get things electronically because they were scanned, hours before the class and typed up frantically by an assistant that I had, that I had to raise my own funds for, incidentally, to pay her salary. So, it was very much do whatever you possibly can to make sure that I've got what I need to pass this class. And, that just didn't include Braille oft times. But I can read it. I haven't in about 16 years.
Okay. You don't use it because of the assistive technology that's now available, or?
It's a bit of both. So I don't believe that it is a necessary, a necessary but insufficient condition for people to pass a degree, to get a job, and to function. I don't think that it's needed. I'm not saying that people shouldn't learn it. It's helpful when you're in an elevator. It's helpful when you're reading a medication box, provided the pharmacist hasn't put tape over the Braille. It's helpful in some very, very specific situations. And I'm not advocating at all for, a complete cessation of all Braille instruction. But what I think is important is that, I used to resist it very strongly. Back in Bermuda, I said, no, this is too slow. I can do this much, much faster on a computer because I could. And I got a lot of resistance to that from the family who had always read, well, it's got to be Braille. Everything has to be Braille, et cetera. And who would, in some situations, waste resources acquiring things in Braille that otherwise could have been provided electronically at much less cost and in a much easier way. So it's a bit of my natural inclination. And it's also shaped by the fact that, I didn't have Braille and I didn't lack for it.
I see. Okay. But in terms of teaching children, for example, literacy and spelling, do you think Braille still has a place in that?
Well, this is coming from someone who's obviously learned three other languages without using it. I think its utility is limited. It does depend on the language and how the orthography works, because obviously a language like French is going to require a lot more aptitude for spelling than Spanish and German, the other languages that I know, by virtue of that, right? So it's hard to make a full judgment of that because it depends on what you're doing. I do think its utility is very limited now. Again, I'm not saying don't teach it. I'm just saying that, you know, once you get past a basic level of competency, I'm not convinced that its use needs to be enforced half as rigorously as it is. And some of the sort of doctrinal issues that I have with it, for example, the narrative that, you know, knowing Braille is going to help you get a job, I would dispute wholeheartedly.
In terms of your role, did your role involve any public speaking?
Yes.
So do you use any technology, or how do you manage doing your public speaking and remembering all of the elements that you've got to talk about?
I will use something like either a laptop to cue it or an AirPod.
Okay. And you'd have JAWS running in your ear?
Mm-hmm. Or VoiceDream or whatever. Wow. I was using.
I know that I can't listen and talk at the same time.
It's a skill.
It's a skill.
I mean, for me, it comes from when I was younger, and they do the thing when you go around the class and everyone has to read. You know, I had all my stuff electronically. I had the stories and whatever that we were doing electronically. So I was like, well, I'm not going to let them pass me. I'm just going to learn how to read from voice. So I did.
Right. Okay. And in terms of learning assistive technology, did you have any challenges with learning or using assistive technologies? And have you got any views on how this could be better?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I didn't have anyone back home who knew how to teach assistive tech, right? They perhaps knew how to install it, but that's about as far as it went. So it was like, well, here's the user guide and a couple of tapes, as it was back then. Let's just go, good luck, go learn it because you're going to need it. So I didn't have a trainer. I had a bunch of tapes and trial and error when I was like 9, 10, 11.
Wow.
And the fact that I had the computer itself, I was lucky. So I didn't have a problem doing it. In terms of learning assistive tech, I find it incredible, you know, that obviously we're in the UK. There are all of these trainers who clearly know how to do this and who have the skills and who can teach young people how to use technology. I don't know, you know, what the experiences of parents are now and what they're dealing with or not dealing with, but I find it incredible that there is all of this resource and all of these people who know what they're doing and know how to teach, and that there are still young people whose knowledge of assistive tech is lacking. It shouldn't happen, I'll be honest. And that's an easy thing to say and a very hard thing to fix. I recognize that. But I know what it's like to be in a situation where you don't have any of those resources and you're told, well, make it happen because you need this to read your history exam in a week. And you do because you have to. And here where we have all of this abundant resource and knowledge, it needs to happen. It absolutely must happen.
You mentioned the technology that you use currently in your work. What's the one piece of technology you couldn't do without?
Well, it would be my main screen reader, I would think. For me, it's JAWS on Windows. I stay away from Mac. But yeah, I couldn't do anything without that in the workplace.
For other blind and partially sighted people looking to get into the legal profession, what advice would you give?
So one on a purely accessibility level and the other on a more professional/legal level. The main advice that I would give first on an accessibility level is you must know, for example, as I said before, you must know Office, you must know web researching techniques, and even some of the more advanced stuff like reading PDFs and accessing track changes and doing all of those kind of things that, you know, you might not necessarily think you need. You must have them. And you're better off learning them before you need them rather than when there's a client on your tail with a deadline. So that's on a on a technical level. On a professional level, I would say the main thing that a law firm, because I can't speak to the barrister route as much, but the main thing that a law firm is going to say, well, what have you done? You know, when have you had a situation where someone has effectively been your client? That's not necessarily, you know, paid work. It could be volunteering. It could be helping out on Citizens Advice Bureau or legal helplines or any of those things that, you know, opportunities that come at university. You must do those things because as a blind person, it's harder, you know, because a lot of people have part-time jobs that they can fall back on and say, well, I was a waitress, I've dealt with difficult clients, I know how to deal with people, I know how to act when I'm being depended on to perform in a specific way. You know, that's harder for us, right? And experience is the killer. Mm-hmm. You know, anyone can get a first from a good university in law, mm-hmm. But experience is the killer. And you've got to find something that you can parlay into experience in some way. read the whole Braille issue. What I wanted to sort of address at in perhaps a little more depth is sort of this narrative that's being pushed nowadays, especially by sort of sight loss organizations. I detest the term sight loss, especially for me because I never had it. The main thing that a lot of these organizations push is this sort of necessity of Braille, and that it will actively help you to get a job and actively help you to, out of the number of people that I know who are working, and obviously this is anecdotal, but out of the number of people that I know who are very much you're functioning professionally, some of them don't know Braille. No one uses it. Mm-hmm. That's my first point. Mm-hmm. My second point is to say that so there were surveys that were done in the past couple of years, and you know they said that out of the 25% of blind people that are actually gainfully employed, all of them of our survey data said that they, knew Braille. Okay, that's a classic, correlation versus causation problem. It's not to say that those 25% who are employed are using Braille on a day-to-day basis, or that it in any way assists them in their professional capacity. And I think actually that if surveys were to ask the question, well, do you use Braille? When was the last time that you used Braille professionally? I think the numbers would tell a far different story. And I was looking this morning on the RNIB's My Voice page about some of the statistics that were out there. And, I think it said that 7% of blind and partially sighted people use Braille. That strikes me as a little bit low, but let's go with it. In that event, let's even double it. Let's be charitable and double it and say, 14% of people. Okay, if 14% of blind and partially sighted people use Braille, you're telling me that 25, 26% of us are employed. So at best, that is half the population of the employed blind population that use Braille, assuming that there's a perfect overlap. So from my perspective, and I recognize this is subject to errors in statistical analysis, and I can see the limits of what I'm saying here, but the point is this isn't a causation issue. This isn't causally related. There's perhaps a correlation at best, but I think it's disputed. And my concern is, if parents especially are hearing this, and they've got a 10-year-old or a 12-year-old or whatever who is resistant to learning Braille, who just wants to do what they need to do on the computer and find ways around things that are technical rather than using Braille. And there's, all they're hearing is, no, you've got to learn Braille. You must have absolutely impeccable Braille skills, because otherwise you won't get a job. I think that's incredibly damaging.
Thank you so much, Matthew, for sharing your thoughts today. It's been an interesting insight to the legal profession and assistive technology that you use and the way forward. If you have any views around technology or an issue affecting blind and partially sighted people that you would like us to feature on the next issue of Blind Spot, please do get in touch.
You've been listening to The Blind Spot, a podcast from Thomas Pocklington Trust. If you'd like to find out more about what we do at TPT, check out our website. Go to www.pocklington-trust.org.uk. And don't forget to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss the next episode. Thank you for listening.